Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 4:40 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is February 25th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, I thought I would kick off with the Ukrainian hryvnia, and it did not make a new low this week. So, obviously, the country has been invaded, and it has caused an enormous amount of stress, and everybody's worried about what's going to happen next. And my daughter, who's 13, had difficulty sleeping last night, and a number of the kids in her class at school feel stressed out about the prospect of a World War III, and that's exactly what is being discussed in social media. And young people are terrified at the prospect of being conscripted. So we're certainly in a point here where there's an element of hysteria circulating among young people. And we saw an element of that in markets this week as well. So we can think about the NASDAQ. It pulled back in an exceptionally violent manner over the course of Thursday, and then unwound all of the decline, and then finished up on the day in here today as well. So we have a large tail on the candle. Now, the uptrend from the low in March of 2020 has been broken. The sequence of higher reaction lows has been clearly damaged. We've seen that the succession of ranges, one above another, has also broken down. So as we think about that trend, well, it's over. And we've also seen that resistance has been encountered in the region of the 200-day moving average. So obviously we're in a medium-term correction, and at one point this week the index had pulled back by about 20%, and that was a signal to at least some people that it was probably time to start buying. I closed out my short yesterday. I opened a long in here today. I think that there is at least the prospect of a reversion back up towards the mean. And that's purely on the basis of a short-term oversold condition against a background where the uncertainty that's been unleashed this week is likely to slow down the pace with which central banks raise interest rates. And that should be supportive for risk assets generally. So we're likely to have at least a short covering rally. Now let's think about what's happening in the gas market. Because this is UK natural gas. It popped on the upside yesterday. And it approached the region of the peaks from late last year. And then it gave up most of the advance in here today. Now, one thing that a lot of people, particularly the energy markets, have been remarking on over the course of the last 6, even 9 months, has been the unwillingness of Gazprom to fill up the gas reserves of Western Europe. Now, some people were willing to think that it was because of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. They wanted to get it permissioned as quick as possible, so they slowed down the supply of gas to Western Europe. And at the time, that was a reasonable conclusion. But in the aftermath of the invasion of Ukraine, well, perhaps there was an alternative motive, that Europe is susceptible to its dependence on Russia for energy. So Russia made a point of ensuring that everybody in Europe understood that before they invaded Ukraine. And what we're starting to see now is that as of today, Gazprom is boosting the gas that it provides to Europe. Now, of course, we're at the 25th of February, so there's really only about a month of winter left. But Europe's not going to run out of gas. And the last thing that Europe is thinking about doing, and that Russia certainly wouldn't want, is that they should keep their coal-fired power stations burning for longer, or that they might even think about reversing the closing down of nuclear facilities in Germany. So Russia is quite likely to flood the European market with as much gas as it can for at least the next few months in order to ease the energy burden on Europe, and also then to act like a good energy partner. And they will attempt to divorce their military actions from their trade actions. And of course, that will be in the hope that eventually investors, governments will begin to look past Ukraine and think of it as a one-off event, and perhaps even then normalize actions with Russia a couple of years down the line. It probably will take at least a couple of years before the image of Russia can be rehabilitated sufficiently in the eyes of the European community, in order to re-establish clear lines of communication, trade, and the removal of some of the sanctions. And from Russia's perspective, that's probably more than satisfactory. And since the Russian banking sector, it was sanctioned. So when we think about the performance of Sberbank, which is far and away the largest lender in the country, well, it pulled back in an exceptionally dramatic manner on the outset of the war, and then bounced by nearly 50% in here today. So it was up $1.57. Now, it's also worth highlighting that the price is in the region of the lows from back in 2008. I think we have to look at the Russian listing to get a clear vision of what that looks like. And we also need to look at the Russian listing to think about where are we in terms of valuations. So we're not quite back in the region of the 2008 lows for the RM listing, but we are back where it was in 2015 and 16, and now we can think about the valuations, because it's on a price to sales ratio of 0.8, price to book of 0.5. So this is certainly not an expensive company. Then we can think about Norilsk Nickel, and it also pulled back in an exceptionally violent manner yesterday and then rebounded in here today off the lows. And the most important thing is that one of the factors that contributed to volatility in Europe yesterday was the exceptional exposure of the European banking sector to Russia. And the European banking index is also now bouncing from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And also coinciding today, the close is at the 200-day moving average. So it's an important area of potential support. European governments were adamant that they did not want to see Russia kicked out of the SWIFT financial transactions network. So that also helped to emphasize the fact that Europe is extremely dependent on Russia, not just on an energy sector or the material sector, but also the financial sector. I used to work in Belgium and Luxembourg for Bloomberg, and a lot of the clients I went to visit were private banks. But the reality is that within Europe, don't just have Switzerland as a private banking sector center, but you have Belgium, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, and Austria, all as significant private banking sector centers in their own right. And they will all have Russian clients. So they will have been lobbying hard to avoid the kinds of sanctions that could really have an effect on Russia. You would probably need sanctions something akin to those that are imposed on North Korea in order to really stay their hand. And since that's just not going to happen, and the Europeans are still unwilling to take a sacrifice in the form of economic growth and recovery in order to deal with Russia, well, then it's quite likely that what we're looking at is climactic action in terms of the stock market response. So that's not unusual. When we think about and this kind of graphic has been doing the rounds over the course of the last 2 weeks. And after the initiation of a war, well, then you tend to get a rebound in the month afterwards. So this has happened in Vietnam, the Gulf War, Afghanistan, the Crimean crisis, and the Iraq War. So then the clear potential is that we're going to see an additional rebound in here as well. When we think about the S&P 500, it was 27% overextended relative to the trend mean from the peak back in November. And I think then we're now right in the region of the 200-day moving average following the close in here this week. If it can sustain a move back above the 4,600 area, well, then it will have broken the sequence of lower rally highs. And I suspect that we do have the potential for a run back up towards those levels. What happens after that is going to be very much influenced by central bank action. So investors are beginning to think that perhaps the Federal Reserve isn't going to be quite as active in raising rates. And 10-year yields, though, are still hovering here around the 2% level. Now, we've had a share of volatility over the course of the last 48 hours, but still holding around this 2% level. And then we've had exceptional volatility in the TIPS market. So the 10-year TIP yield was down in a very dynamic manner yesterday, and then recouped all of the loss. Of course, it's the other way around. There was a big jump in demand for TIPS, and then it really turned around, and people just sold them back down again. But then we can listen to what Christine Lagarde was saying in here today, and she's been quite clear in stating that the ECB isn't going to be raising rates in a hurry, and that they will have to slow down their efforts in order to deal with this situation. So German bunds are around 23 basis points. Now they're also off their low in here today. But there is the real potential that the ECB is going to be very slow in raising rates in here. The Biden administration took the opportunity to do two things during this crisis. The first is that they're looking at the midterm elections in November. So they are very eager to get the oil price down. So they're going to be releasing supply from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. The oil price was well off its high yesterday. It popped on the upside initially today, but closed in mildly negative territory. So we still have some uncertainty in the oil sector, and we're still in a very tight environment. And of course, we're still in a tight environment because the drilling sector hasn't really been particularly active. But with prices marching higher, well, it's inevitable that there will be more drilling. And the oil services sector is right in the region of the upper side of its range over the course of the last year. But it's at a fraction of where it was trading back in 2014. And I think that it is more likely than not we're going to see a breakout over the course of the next week or two. When we think about energy security, well, the kinds of things that could be done to create energy and resource security, they don't look particularly appetizing to a lot of politicians, particularly those currently in office. So the second thing that the Biden administration tried to talk about this week or to push through is a reform of mining laws. Well, mining laws in the USA have taken a charter from 1875 and run with it. And every state has got its own set of individual parameters that they demand from a mining company. And the environmental sector has played this long-term game that they introduce challenges to prospective mining companies, and they drag it through the courts for as long as it takes for the mining company to just give up. So the Resolute mine in Arizona, they first tried to start building it 25 years ago, and it was shut down again just in the last few months. And we've seen a number of mines in prospective mines in Minnesota, for example, and in Arizona as well, over the course of the last month or two, just being shut down as well. So it's difficult to build mines anywhere, but it's especially difficult to build them in the USA. And this talk about a new mining charter, well, there's the real potential that all it will do is duplicate a lot of the regulations that already exist on a state level, and then it could also potentially introduce additional headwinds in terms of the public good, whether that is from an environmental perspective, whether it's from a social justice perspective, or an indigenous rights perspective. All of these factors would then just lengthen the permitting process rather than shorten it. And it takes, on average, about 7 to 10 years to permit a new mine in the USA. And in Canada and Australia, it takes about 2. So it's not that surprising that Canada and Australia are major mining jurisdictions and the USA is not. And it would look like the Biden administration will be attempting to take advantage of the current geopolitical situation to try and push through their reforms. But this is the same administration that capped any kind of potential for the Keystone Pipeline to get built, which basically ensures that Canada's Alberta tar sands have really got to fight for an exporting vector. If oil prices remain well bid because of the shortage, ultimately, if oil service sectors break out, well, then there will be more supply coming. So there will definitely be governmental efforts to try and bring down the price of oil because elections are looming. So if we're in an environment where oil prices start to moderate and central banks are inhibited from raising rates, well, that's generally beneficial for gold. But gold prices surged in here this week and then started to sell back off again. And a good part of the reason for that is because investors are thinking that Russia is going to stop in the Ukraine, and they're unlikely to expand the war beyond its borders. So then the big spike for gold wasn't long lasting, but ultimately when we think about what is it that helps to support gold, well, geopolitics is short-term in nature. Macroeconomics tends to be longer-term in nature. We've broken the sequence of lower rally highs. We have a short-term overbought condition. So it's quite likely that we're going to get some consolidation. And what I think investors will be looking for is support to start coming through around the $1,850 area. And if it does that, well then, that's likely to be very supportive of the generally bull market environment overall. But for the moment at least, we're starting to see commodity prices everywhere starting to come back down. So there was a lot made yesterday of the fact that Russia and the Ukraine are major wheat exporters, and wheat prices popped on the upside and then gave it up in here today. And soybeans also had popped on the upside yesterday and then gave up all of the advance in here today. So it's very likely that what we're now looking at is a short-term peak for commodities, and then certainly potential for some consolidation. It's ultimately where that consolidation bottoms will be the big determinant of just how much we can, or credence we can give to the secular bull market hypothesis. Then I think it's also interesting that copper prices remain quite steady, holding around the $4.50 area and the $10,000 level on that LME contract, and it's been quite inert over the course of the last 2 weeks. But copper miners are beginning to pop on the upside. So as we think about what happens next, well, I suspect again that Russia is going to flood the European market with natural gas. That will help to ameliorate some of the inflationary pressures. Central banks will be less eager to raise rates as a result, and not least because of the still uncertain outlook for their economies. There's still a clear intention to build out renewable energy infrastructure, and that's particularly copper intensive. So copper miners are just beginning to firm here from the region of the 200-day moving average. And the solar sector had come back in an exceptionally volatile manner, and from peak to trough had pulled back by 55%, and then it put in an upside weekly key reversal this week. So there's the significant potential here that this is a low of medium-term significance, that it's firming from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Then the wind ETF also bounced from the region of its trend mean in here this week. And again, another large upside weekly key reversal. Now, the wind sector had not pulled back by as much as solar, but it's also put in a larger upside key and also bouncing from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So this is really quite encouraging action. But we should also consider, why was it that these sectors had pulled back in the first place? And it was very much tied to interest rates, because a lot of the business models that the renewable energy sector relies on are very interest rate sensitive, because they're building now and their cash flows are at some point in the future, and they need low borrowing costs and cheap funding in between building and recouping the investment in order to remain solvent. So if we're going to see a longer interval between interest rate hikes, or less aggressive interest rate hikes, then that's positive for the sector, and a lot of the fat has been cut out of it following steep declines. And then we can think about the kinds of companies that have already got their cash flows sorted out. So Brookfield Renewable Energy Partners, they were able to buy SunPower out of bankruptcy back, I think it was in 2017 or 18. So they have world-class the assets. They're already generating income, but the share pulled back from 50 to 30 over the course of the last 15 months, and it bounced faster than those other sectors. When we think about NextEra Energy, their earnings came through positive But they pulled the stock pulled back exceptionally violently because they announced that they were changing their CEO. But it's a utility, and it has the natural gas and nuclear power backup for its renewable energy infrastructure. So, and it's also the biggest producer of energy in Florida. So this also looks like the potential for at least a short-term low. And it's the biggest utility within the utilities sector, having had a really quite exceptional growth over the course of the last decade. So there's certainly a lot of moving parts within the renewable energy sector, but it's the growth of the sector is something that Russia's betting on. It's something that everybody's betting on in terms of the commodity complex, because there's going to be increasing demand for copper, for steel, aluminium, nickel, cobalt, rare earth metals, manganese, as a result of all of the demand for renewable energy infrastructure, and then also for batteries. So, one thing that I think is rather interesting is there's only really one share that invests in geothermal. So Ormat Technologies surged during the latter part of 2020 and spent just about all of 2021 doing nothing. It pulled back sharply for a while in, I think it was, I'm going to guess the date, but I think it was in 2018 that there was the big volcanic explosion in Hawaii. And that really weighed on the share because one of their installations was in the path of the lava but wasn't ultimately destroyed. But it's the it geothermal is accessible and clean, and it's certainly ticking a lot of boxes, but it can be exceptionally technically difficult because you have to drill deep holes. And then you need to have them, and because the temperatures are so high, then there are technical challenges in getting the heat exchangers to work. And then you're also building in seismically active areas, so it tends to be a rather difficult process. There are new technologies evolving. So there's the real potential that geothermal is going to be one of the growth sectors coming out of this crisis. And I thought it was interesting that this share also had a really substantial upward dynamic in here this week. And there aren't really any other shares that offer exposure to the sector. Then, if we're thinking about the interest rate sensitive portion of the market, well, the ARK Innovation ETF unwound all of the advance from the peak back in early 2020 and bounced in here this week. Now it's below the 1,000-day moving average, and it pulled back for a jolly good reason that a lot of the companies that they're holding don't make any money. But that's less of an issue if interest rates were in fact to start to come back down. Or yields were to come back down and interest rates were to slowly advance. It was, I thought, also notable this week that the yield curve spread is hovering here around the 39 basis point level but didn't contract meaningfully on the news of the invasion. It's also, I think, worth reminding ourselves that the USA might be slowing down the pace with which they raise rates. Europe is certainly going to slow it down, but then China also is starting to inject liquidity into its market. So the renminbi is hovering here. It's been quite steady over the course of the last week, but the People's Bank of China is injecting more liquidity in now than it has since the beginning of the pandemic in early 2020. And Alibaba in here today announced lower growth and lower guidance as well. Now the share was in, it was well off its low yesterday, and it was off its lows in here today. But when A major consumer brand like Alibaba announces that they anticipate that consumer demand is moderating. Well, that raises the potential that the Chinese government isn't going to hit their growth target this year. And the Party Congress is in September, October. So obviously, that's not good news. And it means that the PBOC could be much more active in providing liquidity to the market. Now, if that's the case, and we already know that China is coming out of the trough in its provision of liquidity, that suggests that the three major central banks globally are on the cusp of releasing more liquidity into the market. And that's positive for asset prices. So it's certainly potentially possible that what we've seen this week is a climactic event, and that we might see a substantial rebound from these levels. Now, of course, we're still in a very uncertain environment because of the aggression in Ukraine, which is unjustifiable by any standard, but unfortunately, it is the reality that we have to deal with. And there is the potential that there will be more unpredictable events that occur. What I thought also was relevant in here this week is the defense sector. It rallied, but it rallied today. It didn't really rally yesterday. And it didn't rally more. I would have thought that it was one of the first things I looked at when I started looking at charts yesterday, that I would have thought that the aerospace and defense sector would have bounced in a big way. But it's really only now coming back up to test the sequence of lower rally highs over the course of the last 10 months. So we definitely need to see some upside follow through tomorrow, or I guess next week. And it's been largely range bound since the beginning of 2018. So there's obviously the potential here that there will be more military spending. And of course, military spending requires additional liquidity. It also is rather intensive on commodity demand. And this is obviously true for the US and Europe, and it's also true for China, because iron ore prices are hovering here between the 1,000-day and the 200-day moving average. And China's on the cusp of printing more money and trying to support the economy. An increasingly large number of their property developers are defaulting or getting downgraded into junk or the lowest levels of junk. So a lot of the measures that are being put in place are certainly going to support the state-owned portion of the property market. And we know what this looks like because we've seen exactly the same thing happen with the bankruptcy, or I guess the near bankruptcy, of Yes Bank in India. And it was the state banks have prospered. And I suspect that that's exactly what we're going to see happen in China, that the private portion of the market will experience exceptional difficulty and ultimately will go bust, and the state-owned portion of the market will do significantly better because they get to buy those assets at a discount. And the Nifty index bounced rather impressively in here today. So it's closing back in on the region of the 200-day moving average. As we look at the geopolitical environment, there's certainly it's been my tendency to focus more on the risk from China. And ultimately, the bigger risk was from Russia. Doesn't mean that there's no risk from China. Simply means that the current risk is bigger from Russia, and of course, they are uneasy partners. But what it also means is that the rest of the world needs India to succeed. And that's certainly potentially very, very much of a tailwind for Indian assets. They have a massive demographic dividend that they're going to benefit from over the next 20 years. They've got a democratically elected administration who understand that finding jobs for maybe 40 or 50 million people a year is going to be the number one priority for India for at least the next decade, if not more than that. So there's a lot of infrastructure development starting. There's a lot of reform that's been attempted, and some of it has succeeded in trying to liberalize the market. And we're starting to see more in the way of manufacturing coming through as well. So these are, I think, very significant factors. It doesn't mean that India won't be subject to occasional bouts of extraordinary volatility, but for the foreseeable future, those are going to be buying opportunities. Then we can think about what I've described as the linchpin for investing in emerging markets, which is the dollar. So the dollar index attempted to break out on the news that of the invasion. It didn't hold the high yesterday, and it started to come back down in here today. The Federal Reserve doesn't particularly want to raise rates. They feel like they have to. So when that occurs, or when we think about what the likelihood is that they're going to in fact raise rates by 5 times or 7 times this year, I put it on a very low probability. And if oil prices start to come back down, then that's going to remove some of the inflationary pressures. And one of the primary reasons why the dollar has been firm is because of the belief that the USA would raise rates. So if that's going to slow down, then the real logic for a strong dollar becomes less compelling. So I think that there is scope here for a significant depreciation of the dollar. And if we start to see the dollar depreciating, well, then that's going to be beneficial for emerging markets. And the continued demand growth for resources is going to be beneficial for countries like Brazil. So the Brazilian market is bouncing here this week from the region of the 200-day moving average. The Brazilian real, it got up to test the 5 area earlier on this week and paused over the course of the last 48 hours. But it looks like a base formation. And if the Brazilian real can sustain a move through 5, well, then that's going to be a really momentous event. It's going to greatly encourage more investors to look on Brazil as a potential investment destination. Now, of course, they have an election coming up, and you have, I guess, the devil you know in Lula da Silva, and everybody knows how he presided over an exceptionally corrupt government where every single politician was tied to payments, and yet he was the president during the good times of the commodity boom, so there was money for everything. So there's the real potential he might win, simply on the basis that people want more money in their pockets. And then you have Jair Bolsonaro, who is much more right-wing and has favored cleaning up some of the state-owned companies. And under his administration, Petrobras has cleaned up its act and has paid down debt and become a much slimmer, better-run company, and is throwing off a dividend that is enviable by any standards. They paid special dividends and returns are a return on capital last year of about 14%, and has an indicated yield for this year of about 5%. But of course, when it comes to the security of supply argument. Brazil is a trusted trading partner, and nobody is expecting Brazil to go off and start invading other countries. So then it becomes a more favorable place to do business. It'll be an easier place to invest in, and valuations are more attractive, and the currency is stabilizing. And Brazil was one of the best performing emerging markets during the last commodity bull market because the currency rallied in line with the stock market. So it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that we might see something similar on this occasion. So I think what we're seeing here is a significant change, that some of the most interest rate sensitive portions of the market are starting to attract more interest. And we're getting a rotation and a greater assessment of where risks are in the emerging markets universe. So the kinds of emerging markets that fall into the trusted trading partner type of bracket are likely to attract more interest. And those that represent a geopolitical risk will probably attract less interest. So, what essentially we're seeing right now is an additional risk premium being attached to the market, where a broad spectrum analysis isn't going to cut it. There's going to have to be greater drilling down into the individual risks involved in the standards of governance in each country. And in markets, I used to say in emerging markets, governance is everything, but the reality is simply that governance is everything. So this is obviously going to become a much better appreciated facet of global analysis going forward. So then, if we think about the MSCI Emerging Markets Index, well, it also bounced in here this week from the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and it's been trending downwards for more than a year, and it's right in the region of the upper side of this range that's been forming for most of the last decade. Of course, the emerging markets is mostly China, so if that's the case, well, then China needs to do well to also for this index to also do well. But I think that a lot of the risk that was priced in this week was climactic in nature. The fact that sanctions towards Russia are in many respects toothless and aren't really affecting the country's ability to earn income, pretty much symbolizes that the Russian cabal made the correct assumption that they can do pretty much whatever they like, and they're not going to experience existential risk as a result. And this kind of appeasement isn't a long-term solution to this kind of actions from unpredictable regimes. So ultimately, we know that eventually the bad actors will push it to an extent that will force the hand of everybody else. I suspect that this is going to go in waves, that first Russia invades, then they try to play nice. Then they'll do something else to enrage or embarrass the global economy, and then it will move in this factor until something breaks. And it's quite likely that China will attempt to do the same thing, that they will play bad, then they'll play nice, then they'll do something that will eventually push everyone over the edge. Of course, the difference between Russia and China is that China is the world's first or second largest economy, and Russia is the 11th largest economy. In other words, South Korea's economy is about the same size as all of Russia's. And China is obviously a much bigger fish to fry. So we're certainly in an environment where there are more questions than answers. But the stock market's a voting machine. The action we've seen is climactic, and it suggests that we're being presented with buying opportunities. And if we are moving more into a demand for renewable energy, not simply because of environmental factors, and I was never really sold on the environmental argument in the first place. I just don't believe that moral character is enough to sway the minds of every investor in the world. But the threat of energy security and the growing requirement for energy nationalism is a much more urgent reason to invest in renewable energy. So that, I think, is much more powerful in terms of animating action than the environmental argument. What it suggests, therefore, is that we're going to see the investments promised at the COP26 conference enacted upon. We saw a big move yesterday in the emissions price, and it started to come back down in here today. And I suspect that it's going to pull back into the region of the 200-day moving average, but probably will not fall much more than that, because the Europeans want a high price for carbon. And if oil prices and gas prices start to come back down, well, then they'll just ensure that there's less supply of carbon credits. They certainly want to change how the economy functions, and increasing stress with Russia is only going to increase that determination. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and the weekend, and wish all the best to all of you.